Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with your hosts, Drs. Francine Foss, Anish Chagpar, and Stephen Gore. Dr. Foss is a professor of medicine in the section of medical oncology at the Yale Cancer Center. Dr. Chagpar is associate professor of surgical oncology and director of the breast center at Smilow Cancer Hospital. And Dr. Gore is director of hematological malignancies at Smilow. Yale Cancer Center Answers features weekly conversations about the research, diagnosis, and treatment of cancer. And if you'd like to join the conversation, you can submit questions and comments to canceranswers@yale.edu, or you can leave a voicemail message at 888-234-4YCC. March is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month, and this week we continue our series on colorectal cancer with guest host Dr. Howard Hoxter. Dr. Hoxter is professor of medicine and medical oncology, associate director for clinical sciences, and clinical program leader of the gastrointestinal cancers program at Yale School of Medicine. Dr. Hoxter will be speaking with Dr. Xavier Lohr. Dr. Lohr is medical director of the Colorectal Cancer Prevention Program and co-director of the Cancer Genetics and Prevention Program at Yale School of Medicine. Here's Dr. Howard Hoxter.
Could you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got involved in colorectal cancer and genetics of colorectal cancer?
Sure. So I started when I landed at Dr. Basaitis' lab at the University of Chicago. He was studying molecular mechanisms of colon cancer development. And there I started my interest, and I continued my interest through my fellowship and my and onwards onto my academic career. At the same time, while I was working on research, I started developing my interest in clinical cancer genetics and basically taking care of families who have inherited colon cancer syndrome. So both my research and my clinical interest kind of merge into this field of colon cancer.
You're a gastroenterologist.
Correct.
So you did internal medicine training and all the training that other gastroenterologists have done, as well as your research on genetics.
Correct.
And did you do additional training in the area of genetics as well?
Yeah, I actually got a PhD in molecular medicine, and it was also based on colon cancer genetics.
Uh-huh. Okay. So, so tell us a little bit about the genetics of colon cancer and what leads to colon cancer.
Sure. So there is a multi-stage process where there are several genes that develop mutations that when these mutations start in falling in areas that are key in the control of the development of growth of the human cells, these end up developing into a cancer. It is a multi-step process. It's a long process. We think that colon cancer takes several years to develop, even up to 10 years, and it's the result of these different molecular alterations, genetic alterations that we end up developing into a cancer. This is a very well-described process, but we keep adding more and more information as we learn more, not only about the genetics, but also about what's being called the epigenetics, the modifications of the genetic information afterwards.
So we know that the DNA in the colon lining cells, what we call the epithelium of the colon, has a kind of predictable pattern of events of mutations that lead up to the development of colon cancer.
Correct. And there are several pathways that end up molecular alterations that end up developing into colorectal cancer. And these are different phenotypes or ways of cancer to developing, but many of them are actually shared by the different molecular alterations we're talking about.
Has that led to any improvements in the treatment of colon cancer or prevention of colon cancer?
So certainly, for instance, some of the some of these markers are used in, for instance, the stool-based test for detection of early detection of colon cancer. Some of those markers are used for that. And as you well know, as an oncologist, my better than myself, some of these mutations, KRAS mutations, for instance, are being used in the as part of the armamentarium in terms of deciding about chemotherapeutic agents. So actually, they do have a role both in diagnostics and also in therapeutic decisions.
So you mentioned stool testing. So the FDA this year approved a test based on collecting stool and looking at the DNA for these some of these known mutations. And then there are other ways to test the stool also for blood and so forth. What? How useful are those kind of tests?
So I think there's a lot of research done and quite a bit of progress. We may not be there yet in terms of being those the methods of choice for colon cancer screening. But the test you mentioned, the stool-based test, is already a slight improvement in comparison to the ones that are based on fecal occult blood. But probably there are more improvements to be made to really be a very solid alternative. When it comes to blood-based studies, there's a lot of there are actually several studies being performed, and actually some companies with tests out there, mostly based on methylation or these what we were talking about, these epigenetic changes in the genome that. They base their tests on. And again, those actually do need even more studies in order for us to better understand how good of an alternative they are for colon cancer screening.
So previously, people used to take a little bit of stool, put it on a card, give it back to their doctor to test for blood in the stool using a chemistry test, really. And now you can send your stool, you have to pack it up, but you can send it to a laboratory that will actually look for some of these DNA mutations in the stool and therefore tell you you have to go for a colonoscopy, I guess.
Exactly. So it's, because again, what that's the ultimate diagnostic tool is colonoscopy, and not only the ultimate diagnostic tool, but also the most preventive tool, because through removal of polyps, that's how we prevent colorectal cancer. So
I mean, that's a kind of a key concept that I'd like to reemphasize for our listeners this evening. Colonoscopy can actually prevent colon cancer if they find these polyps, these adenomas, before becomes cancer and it's removed at the time of colonoscopy. You won't get cancer then.
Exactly. That's something that only through colonoscopy we can do. And we believe that the slow but steady decrease in colon cancer incidence in this country is mostly due to this widespread use of colonoscopy and removal of these polyps.
So we're already seeing in the United States today that the incidence of colon cancer has gone down about 10 to 20,000 cases a year, and that seems to be the effect of people going for screening colonoscopy and therefore they never get colon cancer, which is obviously quite a good outcome.
Correct. It's interesting also that colon cancer incidence started going down in the 80s, where colonoscopy was not as widespread as it is now. So we believe that there's also some changes in the environment in our country that probably they were pointing towards the incidence going down. But I think from all we gather, all the numbers that we can gather, the decisive difference has been through the widespread use of colonoscopy.
So is that due to dietary changes? What influences us getting colon cancer to begin with?
Sure. So there are probably the strongest factors in colorectal cancer development are more environmental and dietary than anything else. And there's been study after study associating tobacco and alcohol consumption, a high BMI or high body weight, lack of physical exercise, and some particular dietary habits that have been consistently associated with colon cancer development. What's less clear is how much changing these habits in a radical way, how much you can prevent colon cancer. But study after study have shown that actually these factors do seem to be, play a very important role. And that would also be backed by those studies of migrant populations from low-incidence countries to higher-incidence countries like ours, where rapidly in one generation, the population adopts the frequency of colon cancer than the local population. So certainly that points towards that environment plays a very, very important role.
So is it what we eat or just the fact that people are heavier and fatter?
Maybe it's everything. There are several. There's a very well-conducted study from a large cohort in Europe called EPIC that they put together all these different factors. And actually, in a way, it seemed to add up a little bit. So the more factors of the ones that we mentioned before you have, the higher the chances you have to develop colorectal cancer. So while this is not the math, it looks like probably there's some additive effects of these different deleterious factors towards cancer development.
For a while, the National Cancer Institute was telling everybody to eat fiber and have a bran muffin for breakfast. That doesn't seem to be around so much anymore.
Though, actually, when you look at the main initiatives of the American Cancer Society, lifestyle modification and all these factors seem to be playing a very important role because initiatives such as bringing fresh food to these food desert areas where people do not have access to fresh food, that seems to be highly backed by the American Cancer Society, recognizing that the important effect of these environmental and nutritional factors that are particularly worse in the less favored populations in our country.
And exercise seems to be important, too. I know that Dr. Melinda Irwin here in our School of Epidemiology is actually conducting some randomized trials involving exercise for colon cancer prevention.
It makes a lot of sense because many of the epidemiological studies have shown that there's a clear association. So it makes sense to do these interventions and see how we can prevent colon cancer.
So lifestyle modification can include dietary exercise, things like that, and that may actually help us bring down the incidence of colorectal cancer. But colonoscopy seems to be the key thing that can actually prevent people from progressing to actually getting colon cancer, and we can catch the disease at a time before it becomes malignant. So can you tell us a little bit about colonoscopy?
Sure. So basically, colonoscopy is this test that's done using a flexible rubber tube, size of a little finger, that we put through the anus, and we look at the entire colon or large bowel. And basically what we do is we thoroughly look for this for the presence of these polyps, which are like little growths in the mucosa. And those are the ones that can eventually develop into cancer if they are left alone. So through colonoscopy, we can remove a great deal of them. And it's through this removal of these polyps that the risk of colon cancer does go down dramatically.
So the gastroenterologist takes a scope, takes a look around the whole colon. If he finds a polyp, takes it out, that's diagnostic and preventative.
Exactly, because, well, we don't really know, and we know actually that not all polyps would develop into cancer. We don't have a way to know which ones would develop into cancer and which ones wouldn't. But therefore, we remove them all, and removing them all, we have good data showing that actually, yes, we have we decrease drastically the incidence of colon cancer. So no question that some of those that we're removing would end up being cancer if left alone in that colon.
Would the patient feel it if they were taking out these polyps?
So the colon is an interesting organ. It does feel when we are stretching it. That's why we have that's how the colon communicates to us that we need to go to the bathroom. Yet when we make a little cut, our colon does not feel a thing. It's not primed to feel this kind of feeling. On top of that, we're doing the colonoscopy through either deep sedation or anesthesia. Therefore, it's even less painful. But again, just removing a polyp on itself, because of the anatomy and how we are wired, we don't feel it.
Well, thank you, Dr. Laura. We're going to take a short break for a Medical Minute, and then we're going to come back to learn more about colonoscopy and risk factors for development of colon cancer. You're listening to Yale Cancer Center Answers, and I'm here tonight with Dr. Xavier Lohr.
Breast cancer is the most common cancer in women. In Connecticut alone, approximately 3,000 women will be diagnosed with breast cancer this year, and nearly 200,000 nationwide. But thanks to earlier detection, non-invasive treatments, and novel therapies, there are more options for patients to fight breast cancer than ever before. Women should schedule a baseline mammogram beginning at age 40 or earlier if they have risk factors associated with breast cancer. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, such as Yale Cancer Center and at Smilow Cancer Hospital at Yale New Haven, to make innovative new treatments available to patients. Digital breast tomosynthesis, or 3D mammography, is transforming breast screening by significantly reducing unnecessary procedures while picking up more cancers and eliminating some of the fear and anxiety many women experience. This has been a Medical Minute brought to you as a public service by Yale Cancer Center and Smilow Cancer Hospital at Yale New Haven. More information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut's public media source for news and ideas.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Howard Hoxter, and I'm joined tonight by my guest, Dr. Xavier Lohr. We're discussing colorectal cancer. So, Xavier, you were telling us just about the what's involved with colonoscopy. We said that you could do the biopsies. Nope, you wouldn't feel it. It's really more the when you blow air in there, that's uncomfortable. What does a patient need to do to obtain a colonoscopy, and who should be getting colonoscopies for screening?
Sure. So starting with the basically everyone who has an average risk, meaning no family members with colon cancer, should be getting a colonoscopy starting at age 50. If you are African-American, should be age 45. There's enough evidence showing that African-Americans do develop colon cancer earlier. That's why we want to screen them sooner than the rest of the population.
Wait, so let me just repeat that. Everybody, no matter if somebody in your family had colon cancer or never had colon cancer, no risks. Once you turn 50, if you're Caucasian, you should go for a screening colonoscopy. And if you're African American, you should start at the age 45. And those are for people who have no other specific risk factors.
Exactly. When there's family history, other factors, that should be evaluated in a more specific way. So those we were talking about were people who do not have any special risk factors, as we were saying before.
And we know from studies that have been done, large randomized studies with 10 years of follow-up, whatever, that actually removing polyps prevents people from getting colon cancer. So colon cancer is largely a preventable disease today. We just need to get people to go for this test that nobody really wants to think about, and they certainly don't want to consider the preparations for it. Nobody likes to think about their colon, so it's a little bit of a challenge for us. What do people need to do about preparing for a colonoscopy? Is that something they should worry about?
Well, probably that's the toughest part, quote unquote, because it is very important that when we do the colonoscopy, colon is perfectly clean. If it's not clean, we can miss little polyps. So patients have to take a preparation, half of it the day before, half of it usually the same day of the procedure, and take several glasses every 10 minutes. But basically, the whole idea is really cleaning up that colon really well. So we make sure that when we do the colonoscopy, we're not going to miss any little polyp. We can see everything.
So, I mean, if you're mostly clean, you can wash it off, some stool on the wall, whatever. It's not so bad. But if there, you really need to get everything out more or less, or most of it. If there's still solid stool in there, you're not going to be able to see.
At least everything liquid. If it's solid, it is a problem. And it's very uncomfortable to feel that we have not been able to see the colon well enough, and we may have missed a lesion or a polyp. That's we don't want to face that.
And so then after the clean out, they come to the usually outpatient unit where you have colonoscopy suite, whatever, and the next morning after they prepared, and then it's done with sedation or anesthesia.
Exactly, sedation or anesthesia. So in general, it's a very easy procedure. And most patients tell us that the hardest part was the preparation, not the procedure itself.
Okay. And so, and for then, that's who should get colonoscopy if you're kind of average risk. Who are the people who have higher risks of colon cancer today?
So, about 15 to 20% of individuals do have at least one first degree relative with colon cancer. That puts you in a different category to start with. If the lifetime risk of developing colon cancer in the U.S. is about 5%, having a first-degree relative puts you in a 10 to 15% lifetime risk. So it increases your risk significantly. That's why, in general, we'd recommend to start sooner with colonoscopies and actually do them more often, every 5 years instead of 10 years. If there are no polyps, if there are polyps, then that can vary. And of course, then there's...
If you have a first-degree relative, in other words, a parent or a brother or sister who had colon cancer, you're at a higher risk.
Correct.
And you should go for colonoscopy. When's your first screening colonoscopy supposed to be done?
So it's usually at age 45, or if the family member was relatively young, it would be 10 years before that cancer was diagnosed, before the age of 10 years earlier than the age the cancer was diagnosed in the family member. So that's why we have to really customize that screening to the particular circumstances of that family.
So if your parent or your brother or sister had colon cancer, you should go for screening colonoscopy starting at age 45, unless they were 50 or younger, then you might need to start at 40 or younger.
Exactly.
Okay, and they have a higher risk, they need to do it a little bit more often, that's something the family should know about.
Exactly.
And there are other, you said 15 to 20% of colon cancer is familial-based or has a genetic risk factor associated with it. So what are some of those other families that need to be more concerned about the development of colon cancer?
Yeah, so if 15 to 20 is this group, there's a smaller group, about 5% of all colon cancers, that those belong to what we call syndromes. Basically, what those are is there are different types of diseases that are due to a mutation in a particular gene that can be inherited from one family member from one generation to next generation.
So if you really like to blame your mother for everything that's wrong with you, in this case, you really can.
Absolutely.
Okay.
It can be your father, too.
Oh, your father, too.
50-50
okay.
Chances. But bottom line is that those are cases that, yet being not a large portion of all colon cancers, they're very important because the cancer risk is extremely high, between 70 and close to 100%, for instance, in polyposis syndromes. So this group does deserve a very, very special care. And in many cases now, the genetic defects, the mutations in the genes have been identified, so actually we can test family members and make the recommendations for cancer screening to the individuals who have inherited the mutation, and yet the individuals who have not inherited the mutation in that family, we can reassure them that the risk is not higher than average. So it really helps us a lot now.
So the great thing is we can actually test the DNA of all the family, just take a swab from their mouth, and then if they don't have the gene mutation, if they didn't inherit it, they're the same as everyone else.
Exactly.
And if they do have it, we can watch them much more closely.
Exactly. And the beauty is that we have very good studies showing that watching them closely and doing certain preventive procedures, we do save a lot of lives in this particular family. So it's not by any means a death sentence to have a syndrome like this. What it really tells us that if we know who they have it, diagnosing them is so important because we can make a huge difference in how they'll do.
So one of the more rare ones is called FAP, is that right?
familial adenomatous polyposis. That was actually the very first familial colorectal cancer syndrome that was identified, where individuals develop many, many, many polyps at very, very young ages. And if we then remove the colon, basically almost everyone would develop colon cancer. This is not the most common one. The commonest one would be Lynch syndrome, and that's tougher to diagnose because these individuals do not develop a large number of polyps, and therefore it's very the challenge is to distinguish them from the ones that are what we call sporadic. But those are the most common cases that are due to syndromes, due to inherited genetic defects.
So amongst people who are at high risk for inherited genetic risk factors, the most common one for colon cancer is people who have Lynch syndrome. And they can get other kinds of cancers, too, besides colon cancer. So what do we know about this Lynch syndrome?
Sure. So first of all, is that we don't like to call it colon cancer syndrome. As you said, it's a multi-cancer syndrome. There's a very high risk of endometrial cancer, ovarian. There's lots of other different risks or higher risk of developing cancer. It is inherited from one generation to next generation, and you have 50% chances of inheriting the disease when mom or dad are carriers. All you need is a mutation in one gene. You don't need to have the two, what we call alleles. One always comes from mom, one comes from dad. In this case, we not only need to have one that is mutated, and that will develop into this, will be called developing the syndrome. In general, again, the risk of cancer is high, and there are some preventive measures and tests that actually are being performed in order to prevent those cancers in these families. But the most important thing is the diagnosing everyone who's susceptible to have them and do the right thing on them, and the outcomes are really very different.
What's the specific thing that people inherit that gives them this syndrome?
Right. So they inherit a mutation in one of the genes called mismatch repair. So basically, our DNA chains in our cells, they keep constantly making copies of DNA in our body. So what happens is that because this process is very fast, our body does make mistakes on a regular basis, but we do have a mechanism, which is a group of proteins called mismatch repair proteins, that what they do is basically they recognize some of the mistakes that are made when we are making the DNA chains, and basically recognize them. They recruit other proteins, and all of them work together to fix those mistakes.
So it's a little bit like having spell check on your computer and autocorrect.
Exactly.
Goes in there, fixes a spelling error.
Exactly. That will be a very fair comparison. So when one of these genes is mutated, often what happens is that the protein that they usually produce is no longer produced, and this protein therefore can do this job of fixing those mismatches. What happens is that then the mistake gets made and does not get repaired, and every time the DNA chain keeps making new daughter chains, these mistakes keep reproducing over and over, and we end up generating lots and lots of mutations that when they fall in genes that control cell growth, differentiation, then we end up developing into cancer. So that's what happens with Lynch syndrome.
So in these people with Lynch syndrome, we call it in the colon HNPCC, they have a higher risk of colon cancer. Not everybody's going to get colon cancer for sure, but they have a higher risk. They need to have closer surveillance.
Exactly.
And there can be cancers in other organs, but colon cancer is the main one, right?
Correct. Colon and endometrial will be the main ones. Colon in between 70-80%. Information varies a lot depending on studies looking at large populations versus studies from high-risk clinics. But in general, the highest risk would be for colon and for endometrial cancer.
And endometrial is from the lining of the uterus, so women need to be more concerned about that, obviously. And that makes up what percent of colon cancer?
That would be between 3-5% of all colon cancer.
So most of colon cancer is still this kind of what we call sporadic. It just happens
exactly
because the DNA starts to go bad and makes a polyp, and then eventually with time the polyp turns into cancer.
Correct.
But the job of the gastroenterologist when they're doing the colonoscopy for screening is to actually find the polyps and remove them.
Correct.
And then you won't get cancer at all.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So in other familial syndromes that people should be concerned about?
Sure. So this one, as we said before, it's the most common colon cancer syndrome. But we also know of some other colon cancer syndromes that look like Lynch, but we don't know what's causing them. So there's a lot of research going on in those. And then there's, we mentioned briefly before, the polyposis. We mentioned familial adenomatous polyposis, but there are others like one called MAP, which is MYH-associated polyposis. That's different from the rest of the colon cancer and most cancer syndromes, because this is what we call autosomal recessive. So you need to inherit one damaged genetic copy from mom and one from dad in order to end up developing the disease.
So that's much more rare.
That's much more rare, exactly.
Dr. Xavier Lohr is medical director of the Colorectal Cancer Prevention Program and co-director of the Cancer Genetics and Prevention Program at Yale School of Medicine. We invite you to share your questions and comments. You can send them to canceranswers@yale.edu, or you can leave a voicemail message at 888-234-4YCC. And as an additional resource, archived programs are available in both audio and written form at yalecancercenter.org. We'd like to thank the Yale Cancer Center for providing production support for this program, and we'd also like to thank Renee Gaudet, Emily Fenton, and the staff of the Yale Broadcast and Media Center. I'm Bruce Barber, hoping you'll join us again next Sunday evening at 6 for another edition of Yale Cancer Center Answers here on WNPR, Connecticut's public media source for news and ideas.